This is a interview for the Veterans Oral History Program at UVic. My name is Alexander Morgenthaler, and I am interviewing Brigadier General Mark Dodd at his home. The date is March 6th, 2016. And do I have permission to record this interview?
Yes, that's okay.
Okay, thank you. Let's get started. So, could you please tell us how and why you joined the RCIF?
Well, as a matter of fact, after high school, I was working, and one of the chaps I was working with, who had been in the RCIF during the war, recommended that I might like to do that, to join the RCF and fly. He'd been a pilot, and I was working in Sarnia at the time, and so I went up to London to the recruiting center there, and did all their tests, and actually I was turned down. This would be in early 1950s. I was turned down for eyesight. They said I had astigmatism. So that ended it for then. Several years later, I had moved out to Langley, BC, and there was quite an active flying operation in Langley, and they advertised pilot training to get your private pilot's license, and so I undertook to do that, and I got my private pilot's license. In the process, the instructor, who was also ex-Air Force during the war, allowed us how that I had some natural talents for flying, and he suggested I should apply to the RCAF again, if I was that interested. While it was costing me to rent an airplane, that after I got my license, and I thought, well, somebody would pay me to fly, that would be a good deal, and so I applied, and this time I was passed all their tests. Nobody said anything about my eyesight, and they sent me to London to the personnel selection unit, and I passed the tests there, and next thing I knew, I was sworn in to be a pilot candidate in 1955, and from there the rest is history.
Excellent. You could you please state your general role in NORAD?
In NORAD, well, that was quite a few years later. In fact, towards the end of my career, I'd progressed to the rank of colonel at that particular time. And I was assigned to as a command director in the mountain, the Cheyenne Mountain. And although some of the very senior officers in the NORAD business were not sure that a trash hauler, as I was known as, in other words, a transport pilot, would know much about NORAD and air defense, cause I had no experience in air defense. I'd been mainly on transport-type airplanes. However, I took the training and that they had in the mountain, and things went quite well. And as time went on, I became one of their trainers to train new crews, and including even the new commander of NORAD, to help him understand the battle procedures we had within the command post. So. My main job as a command director was running about 145-150 man crew of mixed, mostly Americans, but some Canadians, on a shift basis. We did two evening shifts, two midnight shifts, and then 2 day shifts, and we had 3 days off, and then we start all over again. And so as time went on, I eventually became the deputy to the American commander in the mountain. And so that gave a little bit more interest. I was still doing command post jobs as well as a command director when needed, to fill in for other people, leaves and things like that. So very interesting 3 years, actually. And totally different from what I had done in the past.
Sounds rather interesting. So you mentioned that your prior experience was as a trash hauler. Could you please elaborate as to...
Well, yes, that's what we were sometimes referred to by our fighter pilot brethren as trash haulers, because we were hauling all sorts of loads in transport airplanes, and many times it was Army. In fact, I would say the bulk of our hauling was Army vehicles and personnel and equipment. But then we hauled everything else, and including actually, and one time we did actually haul trash from a camp in the north that had been established when we were searching for the remains of the Russian satellite, which came in across the north, and they collected all the garbage in the big disposal rigs, and we loaded those on, so we really did haul all the trash away from that lake, haul it off the ice, actually. Excuse me. But mostly it was people just liked to dig at us a little bit. It's fair enough. There's a lot of good-natured name-calling within the service. And we gave as good as we got. Excuse me.
In relation to your transport pilot career, you stated that you flew the boxcar and the C-130?
That's correct, yes.
Could you elaborate as to your experiences with these aircraft?
Well, yes, I could. I was very fortunate. What I wanted to do when I joined the Air Force was to fly large airplanes. I don't know why particularly, although I did enjoy in the training mode the Harvard and the T-33, and after I had got my wings, I had gone on to fly twin-engine expediters, and at the very end of that particular posting, I got to fly the Mitchell, but briefly. It was that was a nice airplane, B-25 Mitchell. Enjoyed that, but fortunately, my boss at the time recognized that several of us young people should go on to bigger and better things, and he was able to persuade headquarters to ship some of us off to transport command, and so I was very fortunate to be selected as one of those to go on the C-119 boxcar. The boxcar, twin-engine, quite a lumbering old thing, but it was a nice airplane to fly. The biggest drawback I found in my 2,500 hours that I flew on that was a tendency for engine failures, and not in the best of circumstances. We ran the engines at a fairly high RPM, and it didn't help for longevity, but we had to in order to get the job done. And some of the engine failures were pretty scary, actually. My first one happened actually in the first year I was on them, and out of Resolute Bay in the Arctic. And we had been doing various resupply operations up there, and we took off to heading for Mold Bay, and just got to altitude, and bang, 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 the starboard engine really acting up. We had to shut it down and turn around and go back and land at Resolute Bay. And the good news about that was that we needed an engine change. The engine was badly broken, and we managed to get a radio message down to Edmonton, and they loaded a new engine in another boxcar, flew it up, and in a day, outside at minus 30, they changed the engine and got us running, and we were back in the air. And just an excellent job. In fact, I think they did a better job than they would do in a warm hangar. They did it quickly, they did it right. The test flight, everything worked fine, and we flew on home. On another occasion, I had an engine failure on takeoff. Turned out it was an overweight airplane as well, but we managed to turn around and get back on the ground. And one other occasion was over the middle of Lake Superior with a load of passengers, and had a runaway propeller, which we managed to finally get it shut down, and we landed out in Michigan. And quite a few of the people swore they'd never fly in a boxcar again. But anyway, it was a good old bird, but we also flew it in the mountains quite a bit. We had a regular scheduled flight from Edmonton out to Comox and up to Port Hardy, and not the best place to be flying a boxcar that tends to lose engines when you're flying over mountainous terrain. And so that was always a little bit of a twitchy feeling, but managed okay. So it was challenging. It was also very satisfying. And I had some good experiences too. And I flew with some really excellent people, a lot of them ex-wartime. In fact, my pilot leader was Bryce Chase, was a real fine gentleman, and gave me a lot of tips on how to keep alive. It was much respected. And, so a lot of time in the Arctic, a lot of time in the Mayo to, that's Edmonton, to Trenton and back, and out to the West Coast. That's about it for boxcar, unless you have any other questions.
No. Actually, now getting back to a slightly different topic, you mentioned a downed satellite.
Yes.
That you were participating in the operation to retrieve. Which operation was that, and could you provide further detail?
Just pause it there a second. Huh?
Okay.
Yes, it was Operation Morning Light, which is the Cosmos 954 re-entering. It's a Russian satellite that actually had nuclear energy in it, and they were concerned about nuclear remains, radioactive remains impacting on Canada, because it re-entered right across the Northwest Territories, from west to east. So we were engaged. I was at Edmonton at the time on 435 Squadron, and we were engaged in searching for the debris, radioactive debris, all across the tundra, right out as far as Coral Harbor, towards the east coast. And so that was quite a big involvement. The helicopter squadron at Edmonton was also involved, and they set up a camp on one of the lakes, and we operated into that lake on ice strips. We had to parachute a bulldozer in, and they cleared the snow off the ice so that we could land Herc's in there. And that was the one I mentioned where we'd flown the garbage out of at the end of the operation. It was a very extensive operation. We were involved very much with the Americans on that, and they helped to us to to modify our Herc's to have proper sensing equipment in them. And it was all done very quickly and efficiently, and without going through all sorts of red tape. It was amazing, actually, the way things were accomplished. We had some very good leaders, and General Carr in Winnipeg, commander of Air Command, and our base commander, was very helpful also. And we did a lot of flights there, some of them in formation with special equipment to sense where the radioactive debris was, and then we would have to pinpoint that so the helicopters could go out and check and retrieve any. It took quite a long time, but it was quite a good operation.
That sounds great. As I would imagine, with your time at NORAD, you went through a lot of bases, and you mentioned in your biography that you were in Cheyenne Mountain at one point.
NORAD, the headquarters of NORAD is actually at Peterson Field in Colorado. Cheyenne Mountain was the organization that was part of NORAD, the main part of NORAD, that actually had all the detection equipment funneled into it. And we had a massive computer system inside. I don't know if you've ever seen any pictures of inside NORAD, but it was big hollowed out caverns and with metal buildings on springs. It was supposed to be fairly nuclear resistant was the idea. Remember that this was back in the days of the Cold War and concern about Russia using nuclear weapons and stuff like that. But I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Could you elaborate as to your experiences?
Some of the experiences, well, learning first of all that there was a lot more to the job than just air defense. That was actually a minor part. A major part of the job was taking in all the data from satellites. We were tracking all the space launches and other missile launches, and also tracking where Soviet submarines were, for one thing. We had one serious incident that I walked in on at a shift change, where it turned out to be a false alert, but it seemed like there was missiles being launched from the Atlantic towards the U.S. And actually, it was a very serious computer glitch, which led eventually to us having a huge overhaul of the computer system within Cheyenne Mountain. That in the early days of computers, you must realize, and computers took up a lot of space, and so it's not surprising that there could be a glitch, but it took a little while to settle things down. Part of the job of the command director was to keep in touch with the commander, American general, four-star general. The deputy was, if he was busy, it was a Canadian three-star, and we had radio contact with them. They carried what was then a very cumbersome portable radio. And that's how we contacted them. And so any major incident, my crew would help me assess, and then I would get on the radio to the boss and say, or recommend a NORAD yes or a NORAD no. And a no was not a threat, and a yes it would be a threat. And then he would, of course, would very quickly want us to get in touch with National Defense Headquarters and also the American headquarters in Washington. So we're getting a lot of data, and a lot of it was classified, and it was rather interesting that the access that we Canadians were given to American intelligence, and of course we were contributing also, but we were treated as equals, which was rather refreshing.
I can imagine. The Your biography also mentioned a UN mission in Egypt.
Yes,
Could
yes.
you elaborate a bit more on
That
that?
was in 19. To check now. February 76, yes. February 76, I was in Ottawa doing a staff job there, and I was selected to go to Egypt as part of the United Nations Emergency Force there. And I went as the Chief Air Staff Officer in the headquarters, which is rather a different situation. In charge of the of UN Air Resources there, and also liaison with the parties, Egypt, Israel in particular, but also we were passing through Lebanon and over to Iraq. We had UN contingents in various places, and of course, stationed in the desert. Remember, the Israelis had come across the Sinai Desert and pushed the Egyptians back to the other side of the canal. And we were there as peacekeepers. My force was, the Air Force was very small. We had two Canadian Buffalo transport airplanes at Ismailia, stationed there. And we also had under contract an F-27, as I best I recall, I think it was based in Cyprus, and we had a Skyvan from I think it was Malaysia, as I recall. That was a long time ago. Just on a contract that we assigned tasks to resupply and haul things to our various contingents out in the desert, and we had Norwegians, Danes. All sorts of NATO troops, scattered around. They all had to be resupplied and kept in touch. So that was my job, was to organize the airlift to support these people, and also while I was there, the Australians volunteered to provide a helicopter detachment there. So I was very much involved in welcoming them to come and do a recce before they brought the helicopters over, and we sorted out where they would be, what they would do, and that sort of thing. And then the introduction of the helicopters. About the time I was leaving, actually, the helicopters arrived, and so that was quite an added asset to have those helicopters, because we were looking after the whole of the Sinai Desert all the way down towards the south. That's a large area. And although I drove all over it through the desert in my little Volkswagen Passat, it was a lot better to have helicopter assets. Well, very interesting. It was only 6 months, but it was a very interesting period. And then I got a very welcome news when my time was up that I was heading back to Edmonton for the third time, and this time as the commanding officer of the HERC squadron, 435 Transport Squadron. So that was a real bonus.
I could, that is very interesting. Did you could you elaborate as to your experiences in regards to the differences between working with NATO versus NORAD?
Well, yes, I guess the interesting that wasn't really NATO, it was the UN. I think that's what you meant, because I didn't really work for NATO.
Yes, I do apologize.
UN. Okay. Well, the UN, of course, multi country background. The chief man that I worked for was a Swede, and his next in line was actually an Indonesian brigadier. And there was various Canadians involved, in the headquarters organization. So working with all these different nationalities was a challenge, and particularly a challenge dealing with the Egyptians and the Israelis, who had totally different concepts to each other and to us. So it took a little bit of skill in diplomacy to keep everything going smoothly, and so we could operate there. On the NORAD side, I found it very similar to a Canadian operation. Of course, the ranks are similar, and the respect that you get was very similar. I would say I was impressed with the way that Canadians were welcomed. The majority of the people that I was working with were Americans, but we were welcomed. And as it turned out, as I worked there, we became more intertwined all the time. And when we finally left, the send off that we got was quite tremendous. And in fact, I think I mentioned to you earlier that I was actually made an honorary NCO. By the men and women of the Cheyenne Mountain, and I treasure that. It was quite a nice thing to have happen. And, we had three very good years there, challenging but rewarding, and our time off was very satisfying too, with some of the best skiing and hiking that you could ask for in the foothills of the Colorado Springs there. So it was a good time.
Can definitely imagine. Mm-hmm. Earlier, you mentioned that you were involved with the early space shuttle.
Yes, while we were there, that was one of the significant items. That the first space shuttle was the preparations for it were underway, and our space crews and staff there had to determine. The orbits of all the junk that's in space now, pieces of old satellites and that are also circling, and they had to help to map out a safe orbit for the space shuttle, which hadn't necessarily been done before by our crews there. So they had a huge job. There's a lot of junk, there must be even more so now, but maybe with the better computers we can track it better than we could then. But I know they were working night and day prior to the launch. Our crews participated in monitoring the launch and providing data, and it all thankfully all went successfully. And we got a big thank you at the end when everything was over and done and they were back safely on Earth. So yeah, that was quite exciting times for that.
Okay. Prior to just going back to a prior subject, you mentioned you were put in charge of the transport squadron. Could you elaborate to your experiences commanding the squadron?
Well, that was really the epitome of I had done two tours on the squadron before and been successful and enjoyed them, and then to eventually go back as the boss was a real pat on the back, and I really appreciated having the opportunity. And it's a good squad, it's a great squadron, actually. And so to be able to be in charge of something like that was very satisfying indeed. Had some really good people. In fact, nearly all were just excellent, and they did their job and they did it well. I mentioned the fact that we did the Operation Morning Light on the Russian satellite. Well, at the same time we were doing that, which was a fair demand on our resources, we were also involved in flying the army, or a part of the army, over to Norway for an exercise there. And so our resources were extremely stressed, but we did it, and we did it all successfully without any serious incidents. And I really felt that, yes, the guys came through when the going got rough, and very, very satisfying that we were able to do all that. And of course, I got a lot of the credit for that, but really the credit was in the troops we had, very, very good staff and capable. And all the ground support staff that supported us were just great. So, good times.
Indeed. So, in regards to one of the postings mentioned in your biography, you were posted to National Defense Headquarters?
Yes.
Could you elaborate a bit more on that?
Oh, that was a bit of a surprise, actually. You have to do a certain amount of ground tours, particularly if you're moving up the ladder. You have to get different experiences. And I hadn't done any time in National Defense Headquarters. I guess the career managers, well, first of all, they had a slot they had to cover, and I guess I was next in line to get some time on the ground. So that was a surprise. And as a director of reserves coordination, which was something totally different than what I'd been used to, I hadn't been dealing with reserves to any extent at all. And we were unified by then, so I was working for an army boss. But one of the good things was I talked to him when I first got there and said I'd really like to keep doing a bit of flying. And he agreed that if I could work it with Air Transport Command, that he was agreeable to give me some time off to fly a bit, which I was able to do. And I flew part-time with 436 Squadron. That's also Herc Squadron, the one down east, and that time based in Trenton. So I used to, on weekends, commute down there and fly a bit and then back. And one of the things, the main thing of the job was to coordinate reserve activities. It was in the time when the headquarters were trying to regenerate more interest in the reserves, and a lot of things had to be tidied up of what they could do, what they couldn't do, and how they're going to be supported, things like that. And we also, when I was there, we took over the student summer employment program and tried to manage that, which is about an $8 million a year program, which was fairly significant. And I got to visit a few of the reserve units, things like that. But it wasn't sort of job that I really wanted. I didn't care for being in the headquarters particularly, but it was good experience nonetheless, and I worked for some interesting people and some senior officers of all Army, Navy, and Air Force, and got to know them quite well and what their demands were. So I was able to be fairly supportive in that role. But it was a breath of fresh air when I got a chance to. Even though it was Egypt that I had to go to, it got me out of the headquarters anyway.
That's great. You mentioned the unification of the forces. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate? as to your experiences with that and whether it affected NORAD relations at all?
It was different. I wasn't very happy with it. I was when unification came about, and of course it was a big unknown what it was how it was going to evolve. But overnight, I became, instead of being a squadron leader, which I was a new squadron leader at the time, I automatically became a major. One advantage to that was that if we were dealing with the Americans, they understood majors better than squadron leaders. They didn't have squadron leaders, wing commanders, group captains, that sort of thing. So there was an advantage that way, because we dealt with the Americans a lot, particularly when transporting around the world. We used their facilities a lot, so it made more sense to them that they could know what we were. But it was confusing. There was a lot of the things we had to learn to do the Army way, and the Army had to do some things the Air Force way. But I think the Army and Navy had more weight than we did in the way things happened. We were all in green, of course, and I didn't care for the new uniforms particularly. But shortly after that, I was sent to Mobile Command in Montreal, which was the Army, really, but they called it Mobile Command then, but it had been the Canadian Army before. And I was sent there as a liaison officer for Air Transport Command, because there was a lot of difficulty between the two commands in organizing airlifts, particularly of the Army. So after I got there and managed to get Army talking to Air Force and understanding each other, in about 6 months I'd worked myself out of a job. But then Ottawa said, we're not going to move him out of there. We just paid to move him down there. We're not going to move him, so he can stay on as part of Mobile Command staff. So that's what I did. Instead of being an Air Transport Command liaison officer, I then became a Mobile Command staff officer, primarily involved in organizing the airlift of Army troops. I was there actually for the October crisis, 1970, where we moved half the Army into Quebec, to quell the unrest. And interesting times, very interesting. Fortunately, I worked for a very good boss, Army boss, whose son is now the Chief of the Defense Staff. So it was kind of nice. But I look back on my time in Mobile Command. I worked with a lot of Army brass, and I have a lot of respect for them. They knew their job well, so I learned to do mine fairly well, and moved on from there.
Excellent. So, in regards to your the NORAD portion of your career, were there any particular highlights that you'd like to elaborate on, or?
Not that I, other than I think we already discussed the false alarm one, that was fairly significant, but no, mainly it was a day-to-day operation, and I was being involved in the switchover when we got the new computers, which was a major undertaking, because we had to keep full-time operation while they were switching out the computer components, and we had to be very careful of not taking glitches too seriously. We had to double check and double check sort of thing. The rest of the time was fairly routine, and nothing particularly comes to mind right now. I think I mentioned earlier that had been involved in the training of a new commander, which was quite an interesting thing. I shouldn't say the training of he was new to the system, and he wanted to be totally familiar with the command post operation when he had to deploy there. And we did have, because I was kind of designated as the trainer, I should say. I had to be very careful what I said, a 4-star general, but some of the things he did I didn't agree with, and so I had to be tactful and suggest that maybe that was not the way to do it. And he was a bit bloody-minded, but I respectfully disagreed with him. But the next morning, when he came back in for another session, he had the good grace to get everybody's attention and say, just a minute now, what Mark Dodd said yesterday, and I disagreed with, he was right. Now let's get on with the goddamn job. I thought that was rather graceful, and at least let it be known that though we had disagreed, and I think I was fairly polite in my disagreement, but at least he admitted it and gave me credit for it, so it was kind of nice. And we got along quite well after that. He was a gruff, blunt guy, but direct. I understood that, and we knew where we were with each other. And there was no mincing of words. I appreciated that.
I can quite imagine. In your biography, you mentioned quite a few postings for pilot training for the C-130. Can you elaborate as to some of your experiences with that?
The postings or the trips?
Both.
Okay. my training on the 130, initial training on the 130 was at Edmonton. It was a local checkout. After that, we also did a refresher on so that we could do paradrops and supply drops, that sort of thing. Little courses for that. But that was about it for the training. And then I became a trainer myself, which was at Trenton. And I went to Trenton to train crews on the 130. Quite enjoyed that. Eventually, towards the end of my tour there, I became the chief pilot instructor, Hercules, and bit of a nice touch to be designated as such. We trained pilots. We'd run a course, say, for first officers, and then every once in a while we'd run a course for captains, and so that'd be the first officers coming back after gaining some experience, and they'd come and we'd run them through a whole series of checks and trips and stuff like that. Make sure they're good captain material and do an assessment on them, that sort of thing. I found that very, very satisfying, and some of the trips we did were challenging with the new people, but one of the things that comes to mind was that, particularly with the first officers, new people on the airplane, quite often we found that people who'd been flying single-engine fighter guys that were now doing a tour of multi-engine, that quite often they didn't use a crew the way the rest of us did. That they tended to try and do everything themselves, while in a big airplane with a lot of different roles, it's a bit much for one guy to try and do it all. You can't reach all the switches, for one thing. You've got to use your engineer, and you've got to use your loadmaster, and things like that. And so that was always interesting. Very capable pilots, but you know, there's only so much you can do yourself. You've got to learn to use a crew. Well, that was just an aside. But good times. We did some great trips. The captain's trips, we went out to the Pacific, Hong Kong and back type of thing. And my first trip, you know, first trip out in the Pacific was a captain's course. I had two captain students. And it's the blind leading the blind. I'd never been out there myself. And I'm showing these guys how to do it. And, we landed in, I don't know if it wasn't the first trip necessarily, but one of the trips anyway. We landed in Nagoya late at night. Everybody's tired. And the captain student was flying the airplane, and I'm in the right seat. And we're taxi down the runway in Nagoya, and the chap in the tower there says, Canadian Air Force 2204, turn light. Well, I didn't quite understand him, so I flicked the landing lights. He says, oh, no, we're rolling down the runway. He says, no, Canadian Air Force, now turn left. It finally dawned on me. So we turned left. Sometimes and do stupid things. Anyway, interesting. And lots of fun, too.
I can quite imagine. Earlier on, you mentioned, or you showed me, that there was quite a send-off when you left NORAD.
Can you yes, yeah. That? Actually, we were quite surprised that the crew we had entertained the crew at our home a few times, and other than that, we hadn't had very much in the way of social time with the whole crew. Well, it turned out that they not just the crew, but some of the headquarters people also decided to send us off in style and with a bit of a party at the officers' mess. Mm-hmm. And they presented us with all sorts of nice tokens, plaques and things. So it was quite a warm feeling that we left. And also, I think I mentioned to you that I was really pleased to get this honorary NCO award from the enlisted men and women. Very nice gesture. I prize it very much.
Okay. And just to clarify, NCO means non-commissioned officer.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And just going a little bit off that, since you moved postings quite a bit, how did this affect family? And
well, fortunately, my family was quite resilient, a very supportive wife. I'm grateful for that. Our kids, it wasn't easy for them, changing schools all the time, and having gone through that sort of thing myself, changing school at a young age, it's not easy, but they bore up very well, and I'm pleased to say they coped with the moves. We were quite a close family. We spent time together, camping and that sort of thing. We traveled a bit and as family. But they were also involved themselves in youth activities, which was good. And they got along, which we helped them as much as we could with the schooling changes and things like that. But they bore up very well indeed. Fortunately, my wife was a stay-at-home mom, so she was there for them a lot too, which was great. Particularly when I was on squadron and flying, and you know, gone for days at a time and come home and change clothes and go back out and on another trip. It really needed to have somebody there stable for them, and so she was extremely supportive in that regard. I appreciate it. Well, we were a good team, and that's what it takes. Kids, I'm sure they missed out on some things, particularly long-term relations with their peers. But on the other hand, they had a very broad exposure. In fact, my wife even brought the kids over to Israel when I was there, and I was able to get a week off, and we toured around Israel with the kids when they were teenagers. And so that was quite an eye-opener for them, too, to see that.
Definitely has its advantages.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you were in Israel. Could you elaborate on that? Or
in Israel?
Yeah.
Well, other than what I've told you already, I was back and forth into Israel from Ismailia. I was based in Ismailia, which is right on the canal. But I would, because we had troops stationed all through there, and so I would go to Jerusalem and other places there, but just mainly as part of my liaison with Israeli Air Force and make sure that the UN was accepted in those areas. Make sure our airplanes could get in and out, that sort of thing.
Excellent. So you mentioned that you flew with the transport squadron for a exercise in Norway, and you also mentioned that when you were that this was in conjunction with Operation Morning Light.
Mm-hmm.
Could you elaborate as to further missions that the transport squadron
participated
in?
Variety of things, because we supported Army, Air Force, and Navy on the various deployments. Apart from that, there was special missions which the Canadian government decided that the Air Force could do, whether it was resupply of food or whatever, to various countries that they thought they could help. Major activity actually with the squadron, both on the boxcar and the Herc, is resupply of the Arctic weather sites. And we did that twice a year, which was a major airlift of all their fuel and other supplies and building materials and stuff like that. Because there was Mold Bay, Isaacson, Eureka, and Alert, joint Arctic weather sites. The runways were only open at various times of the year. And so what's when we flew everything in from Resolute Bay or from Thule in Greenland, which was another site. So that was just general cargo, but a lot of fuel. And we rolled a lot of barrels of fuel into these various sites. Because they didn't keep the runways open in those days like they can now. They now have the equipment they can keep the runways open during the winter. So a lot of that. The next time I go to Alert, right on the very tip of the Arctic, will be my 51st landing. That's the number of times I've been into Alert, back and forth, because when we do resupply to Alert, we'd pick up our stuff in Thule, Greenland. We could could come in there by ship, and then we could get it from Thule and fly it in there. It's about an hour and a half back and forth, three trips a day sort of thing. So there's three landings a day that adds up over the years. But in the early days, it was all, you know, in barrels, 45-gallon barrels, and the crew would help roll them off. When you get back in, you're all sweaty. And actually, my first trip to the Arctic, we took a survival course up to Cambridge Bay, and it was about 30 below, and we landed at Cambridge Bay, and we had to refuel from drums, so we had to go to the stack of drums and roll these drums over to the airplane, and wobble pump up into the wing, and then, you know, get another one, pump another one, and then roll them all, the empties, back and stack them up, and then get back in the airplane. It was my turn to fly on the way back. Excuse me. Anyway, I get in the cockpit and we start doing the checks, and I whip off my glove and put my fingers on the starter switch and on the primer switch, and we get the engine going, and I take my finger away and I leave the two fingertips stuck to the switches because my hand had been sweaty when I took my glove off. 35 below, the inside of the airplane is 35 below. That was my first lesson about Arctic operations, leaving my fingertips stuck to the switches. But a lot of flying in the Arctic, resupply and Christmas drops, because these remote sites weren't available at Christmas time. So we would fly over in moonlight and drop the mail and any other critical supplies and a Christmas tree, wrapped up